Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
My name is Jerome, and I'm a very grateful and fortunate member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for the fact that I've been spared from an insidious illness called chronic acute alcoholism. See, something happens to me. Not some of the time, not most of the time. Every single time I take anything that breaches the blood-brain barrier, it reaches the topmost part of my brain and kills the will to care. See, I'm one of those allergic types that can't take alcohol in any form. And there are many forms. And why am I fortunate? It's just by God's grace that I'm here tonight. Left to my own devices, I would have stumbled along to a tragic and violent death as a result of chronic acute alcoholism. Because, see, I only drank to four states. Either I passed out, blacked out, fell out, or my mouth would encourage someone to knock me out. And I'll take anything once. See, I suffer from an illness of a fourfold nature. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind, reinforced and sustained by a spiritual malady. I learned that from a guy when I was in Toronto at the International Convention. And he asked, he says, "Do you know where that came from?" And I had heard it many, many times in many different ways in different meetings, and I never knew where it came from. He said, "That is a direct quote from Dr. Benjamin Rush." I had never heard of Dr. Benjamin Rush. He told me, he says, he's one of the original signers of the Declaration of Independence. He signed it just above John Hancock. He was a young American physician, sometimes known as the Doctor of American Medicine. He wrote the first thesis paper on alcoholism. He had did extensive study on this illness. And as you know, in our culture, in American culture, they have always viewed alcoholism as some moral dilemma or some human failing. The person was a sinner. And that's the reason why he had this disease. But he had a different view on that. He said that people who are these allergic types like alcohol because it changes their spirit. And I believe all human beings, especially me, is born with a spirit, just like an emotional temperament or a personality trait. And I'm not going to get into why I have this spiritual illness, because that's just like having diarrhea and want to know why I have diarrhea. It might be better if I look for a restroom. See, this spiritual malady that I suffer from, although it affects my body, my mind, and my emotions, has some definite symptoms. Just like a cold has symptoms. You cough, you have a fever and body ache. The spiritual malady has some definite symptoms too. And Dr. Silfworth picked up on those symptoms from Dr. Benjamin Rush in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous and the doctor's opinion. He said that men and women essentially drank because they like the effects produced by alcohol. And although it is injurious, after a time, they can't differentiate the true from the false, which to me says they suffer from a subtle form of insanity. And he says when they're not drinking, they feel restless, irritable, and discontent. Those are those core symptoms of the spiritual malady. And if you are the allergic type like me, I will always have this spiritual malady. I will always feel some separateness from my God. And when I feel separateness from my God, I feel restless, irritable, and discontent. And if I don't deal with that, I become angry, separate, alone, and afraid. Then the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair descend on me and tap dance on my forehead. And I become restless, irritable, and I become angry, separate, alone, and afraid, driven by 100 forms of fear and delusion. Then I will look for something to alter my spirit. And we all know this if you happen to be the allergic type and alcoholic. Alcohol and these psychoactive substances, the myriad of them, will change your spirit instantly. They work every time. It's almost an instantaneous thing. It's like that first time I drank. Coming from that Baptist home, I hadn't had any experience with alcohol. My parents didn't drink. My dad maybe played the horses every now and then with his sister, but he didn't drink. Not with all them kids. He couldn't afford it. On the summer of 1962, I got a chance to go to my first high school dance. And me, Mad Dog, Rabbit, and Pookie was going to the dance. And somebody said, "There's old Joe the wino. Let's proposition him to get us something to drink." And I didn't want to seem like no chump, no poop butt, so I went along with the program. We asked Joe, said, "Well, what are y'all drinking?" I said, "Joe, whatever you drinking." Joe went and got some Excello white port. Hot. Dust on the bottle. It wasn't a grape in that wine. It was all chemical. And he gave us an art of connoisseur of fine wines. He said, "You need to cut this with some strawberry Kool-Aid." And unbeknownst to me, I was going to be introduced to the original wine cooler. And that was the most foulest beverage I had ever tasted in my whole adult life. It made me gag. Something said, "Spit it up." You know, that quiet voice. But that loud voice said, "Hold it down. Be a reflection on your manhood." And I got that instantaneous rush. I knew three things. I knew I could act. I knew I could perform. And I knew it didn't matter what anybody thought about it. That alteration in my spirit was indelibly engraved on my consciousness. It altered a part of my brain where I knew anytime I felt restless, irritable, and discontent, all I have to do is take some of that and it would vanish. And I was under the illusion that I could control it. God knows I didn't know I was going to go on a ride for my life to where it was going to take me, where getting up just didn't cross my mind. And what happened was, it was nothing shorter than a miracle. I believe that this power that permeates this here, this world, this loving God, held me in the palm of his hand all through that madness. Even in my ignorance and my belligerence, he held me in his hands. Coming from a kind of really good religious background, I had separated myself from all that. My mom and sister could be in there in the living room doing their Bible lesson. I'm unemployable, ain't worked in years, toe up from the flow up, and I walk in there feeling so separate, alone, and I say, "Mom, will you please say a prayer for me?" And go drink some of that wine and come back and turn out the house. Get real belligerent, tell them, "I don't see why y'all praying. Prayers ain't going no further than the ceiling. And God don't come to South Central after dusk." An agnostic and a belligerent unbeliever, and this power just held me in my own madness. And I used to think I had something to do with it, but I think it was an act of providence. See, everything I went through was not for Jerome. It's for this here purpose that God has left me here for. And that purpose is quite simple. It's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. My main purpose today in life is to be of maximum service to my God and my fellow man. And I was so far from that, I was lost. I was just lost in that madness. But those loving parents never gave up on me. I knew it was their prayers, and some strangers on the street was praying for me. You know how you get so caught up in that madness, and alcohol and drugs is not doing it anymore. You live in the use and you drink in the live, and it's not taking away that madness. I happen to know that God will send an angel and touch you on the shoulder and tell you to go another way. What happened for me was in 1972, I ended up in Camarillo State Hospital. And it was an alcoholism program. And I met this young lady. Boy meets girl on the Nut House campus and falls in love. And she had some experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. Her whole purpose was not to become romantically or intimately involved with me. But although what had happened to me was her kindness touched a part of me that made me says, yeah, Jerome, just possibly you're worth something. Just possibly you could get better. But I went about it the wrong way. I thought it was through her. And she said, I got out of that hospital, and you know, as soon as you get out of treatment, it's such a stressful experience that you need a little refreshments to kind of calm you down. And the only refreshments I knew was a drink. And she came and took me to this meeting. First AA meeting outside of an institution. And we're walking up to this meeting. It's a huge meeting in L.A. It's not there anymore. It's long since disbanded. It's called the Wilshire Normandy Group. At the Presbyterian Church down in the basement, be about 400 people in the room. And she wanted to take me to this meeting. And I'm trying to convince her that if she would be my sponsor and I would be her sponsor, we could work this recovery thing out. And she was telling me, she said, no, Jay, I don't think that's going to work. I'm becoming belligerent because I'm intoxicated. And it was this guy at the meeting who was welcoming the newcomers in the meeting, overheard the conversation. I had never met this man before. He walked over into the conversation and says, I'll be your sponsor. I looked at him. If looks could have killed, he would have been dead. Don't interrupt me and my baby's conversation. Can you see I'm trying to get my rap on? And he whipped out his AA business card. It says, Jack K is my name and sobriety is my game. And I went and sat at the meeting. I read it. I says, damn, he's a poet too. For 10 months, I collected those cards and never did I call him. I never called him but one time coming out of DT's. One time. And I ended up back in Camarillo for another 90 days. And it was in the latter part of May of 1973, another young man had Jack's card. Jack sponsored him too. His name was Raymond. Collect call. Jack left his plush home in West Hollywood and drove up there to pick up this young man from South Central. And I'm sitting in the mental institution reading the Los Angeles Times business section if I had some stocks or bonds. See, I had worked for IBM. in 1969, and I had bought one share of IBM stock in the employee purchasing plan. So 4 years later, I'm checking to see if it had split. And Jack eased up behind the paper, and I didn't see him. But see, in those 10 months, he never forgot my name. It wasn't, hey, you homeboy, how you doing? He would always come up and say, Jerome, how you doing? And I had that newcomer line. I'm fine. I was lying. I needed some help bad. And he came behind that paper and he says, Jerome, what are you doing here? And in my mind, I didn't say it out loud, but in my mind, I said, damn, he done followed me to the nut house. And he asked me a simple question. What are you doing here? And for a brief moment, I got honest with another human being, contrary to my general way of doing things. I got honest. And I told Jack, I don't know. I don't know why I'm here for the second time. See, because I didn't know I suffered from a disease of a fourfold nature. I had no idea. I thought I was just down on my luck. No, I really thought I was crazy. I thought I was beyond redemption. See, because I'm not a has-been, I'm a never was. But that day in the latter part of May in 1973, that man Jack did something for me that I couldn't do for myself. Standing in front of me was a man shouting good tidings. He was shouting tidings to a lost, battered soul, saying, "If do thy want to be whole." And I knew that, you know, an alcoholic can tell when someone is judging him in an instant. And Jack was not judging me. He wasn't coming from some lofty spiritual mountain. He was right there with me in that pain and that madness. And I could look in those blue eyes and he says, Jerome, if you follow what I follow and do what I do, you will never have to drink as long as you live. And he said, you will never have to come to a place like this unless you choose to. But see, I have something even today that will keep me spiritually sick. Because I can be spiritually sick. I really do. Because see, I'm getting ahead of myself. You know, it's like he was inviting me to a banquet. And I chose to have a cup of water and a cracker. Because in my head, I knew he was sincere, but I said, you ain't nothing. You worthless. Why even waste his time? And 5 days later, I'm on the jailhouse floor at Parker Center, and all I could do is see what he was telling me. And I said, if I could get off this floor, I'm going to do whatever Jack Kissel tell me to do. If he asks me to jump, I'm going to ask him how high. It wasn't to get out of jail. It wasn't to make restitution to the harm and hurt I had done my parents that weekend. Because I had showed up at their house out of the hospital and bust out all their front windows and assaulted my dad, beat him, sent him to the emergency room. Came back the next day, ran into my auntie's house. She pulled a pistol on me because she wasn't going to take no butt whooping. And I ended up back in jail. And I got off that floor. And you know, it's nothing shorter than a miracle. What happened was that I had no place to go. Too prideful to tell the people in the meeting I didn't have a place to lay my head. I said, I'll walk back downtown to Skid Row and sleep in a show. And that quiet voice of my God said, Jerome, if you go down to Skid Row, you go down to Skid Row to die, and you won't be coming back this time. And I only knew one place to go and ask for help, and that was my father, the one I had assaulted the day before. And I walked up to his door at 3 o'clock in the morning and told him, he says, Dad, will you please help me one more time? This is the man that always come to the hospitals, the jails, put his house up, bail me out, get lawyers. And I got out of the hospital and I assaulted him, the deacon. Hate-love relationship. Jack showed me how to rebuild that relationship back. He says that it's imperative that I make spiritual amends. And I'm still making spiritual amends to that relationship today by being a father and a husband like my dad to the best of my ability. But I got off that floor with absolutely no viable skills. I only worked at one job at IBM for almost a year, and my psychiatrist had got me that job. And I got introduced to God by the members of my home group, because I was trying to impress them by going to work and being a viable member of society and the community. And they insisted that I work and not be on welfare. Because this guy came up and told me, he said, well, why are you on welfare? I said, well, I'm receiving SSI and I'm on ATD. And he said, well, why do you get that? I say, I'm crazy. And the guy in my home group said, you ain't crazy. Anybody that know they get a check can't be crazy. He said, you playing crazy. And he said, there's a distinct line, Jerome, between playing crazy and being crazy. Sometimes you think you playing, you done skipped across the line. And he said, if I were you, I wouldn't play with your sanity. But Jack took me through the steps, and he took me through the steps in a very peculiar way. I don't hear a lot of it said at the meetings, but this is how he took me through the steps. Because like I said, I was an agnostic and a belligerent unbeliever. And I would be riding with him and he would talk about how his God is doing for him. And I just get uptight. And I get out of his car and slam the door. Bam. And he wouldn't get upset with me. He was very calm. It seemed he was, I always thought he was very spiritual. And he'd roll down the window in that quiet, sincere voice, he says, Jerome, anytime you hear the word God, just add another O and call it good. Then he asked me that question. He said, ain't it good you sober today? Even though I didn't have the material trappings, it was good to be sober today. Because, see, I was beginning to get in touch with this power in those rooms. But see, we had to do a lot of cleaning up. But see, I'm a firm believer. God won't stay in a dirty house. He will visit, but he won't stay. And my house was very dirty. Oh yeah, I'll clean it up the front room, but I would leave the bad the bedroom, the restroom, the closets all nasty. Because you wouldn't go back there, right? But Jack showed me how to clean my house. Here's what he told me to do. And I don't know if we have any new friends in here struggling with the spiritual aspect of the program. Because I believe people relapse spiritually first. They get caught up in those symptoms of the spiritual malady, restless, irritable, discontent, angry, separate, alone, and afraid. I believe they get caught up in that and they don't treat it. They can't treat it by themselves. They need God and their fellow man to treat it. Then they go along and next thing you know, they're emotionally loaded. Because their spirit is so whack. Now they're depressed, they're suffering from anxiety, and they got all these other psychiatric illnesses. And what do? They run right down there to the doctor, and they lay out all them symptoms, and the doctor say, I got the pill for you. And then they wonder, what happened? The very same thing that happens in the big book, it says. As long as we don't put anything in our body, we act and perform like all other men. But the minute we put something in our body, something happens in the bodily and the mental senses that make it virtually impossible for us to stop. And we'll start off with that doctor. And next thing you know, we're at the dope man's house in the liquor store. And we wonder, what happened? Well, what happened was when you felt restless, irritable, and discontent, you didn't seek any treatment for it, for that spiritual malady. You want to hold on to some of the worst items in stock. You didn't want a clean house. You just want, well, I'm going to say Jerome just wanted to clean up the living room. So I could have you over and impress you how clean my house is. But when you got to go to the kitchen, I say, hold up, I'll go get you a drink of water. I don't want you back there. So what he told me to do is, says, here's Jerome, we're going to do this in a very simplistic way. And he laid out this formula. He says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to read the doctor's opinion. Because it's very imperative that you know and have a fundamental understanding of this illness from a medical standpoint. Because there are some medical implications to it. Then he says, we're going to skip Bill's story. Bill has an interesting story. We'll go back to that later when we do the other work and read his story, and we'll get that spiritual bang that he talks about. Because I think you need a spiritual awakening of the educational variety. We're going to do this slow and methodically. See, I want you to read There's a Solution, because it's imperative for you to realize, left to your own resources, you are utterly hopeless. There's no single-handed victory against alcoholism. Because I suffer from this subtle insanity. And I don't know when it's going to pop up. See, this insanity lasts for 5 seconds and it runs along my sound reasoning. You know that part of my brain that said, don't play on the 405 freeway. At no time of the day. Right along that sound reasoning is this trivial idea, and it pops up with dominance, says, oh, you could have one. And you remember how good it made you feel? It never talks about how bad it made you feel. It only talks about how good it made you feel. It'll bring it up in all its glory and wonder. How it changed your spirit and you felt omnipotent and powerful. It never sees you crawling on the floor in your own filth. Always you doing good. Oh, it's trying to trick you again. That's that insanity. And I used to hear a lot of people saying in meetings, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle happens. An alcoholic does not have 5 minutes. He don't, because in 5 seconds, he'll make a decision that will alter his life permanently. Because, see, that obsession of the mind we talk about is not going anywhere. It's going to sit there where it says, cunning, baffling, patient. It sits there. And this obsession of the mind, in the beginning of your recovery, it walks right up to you and try to hijack you right out of the meat. That's what it does. That's why it shouldn't be surprised that people new in recovery are struggling. Because it walks up and hijacks them. It says, oh, that speaker was, he sucked. Let's go. Oh, they all cliquish at the meeting. Let's go. It just come and snatch you out. It don't say, let's go drink. It throws you into that spiritual denial. Because we will deny that spiritual malady. Because when we start probing it, we get real defensive. Well, I'm talking to me. I say, Jerome, when I say we, I'm talking about not just you. I'm talking about me. Get real defensive. Then we get real emotional. Then I get real negative about it. Then I'm impulsive. Then I'm angry. And I used to think I used to be lonely, but no. I'm not lonely at all. I'm lazy. I'm going to do it. I'm going to go. I'm going to call him. It's classic. Even today, 36 years sober, right? My sponsor died in November. I've been thinking about a sponsor. Yeah. And my wife she'd say, when you going to get a sponsor? She's concerned about my spiritual well-being because she can't be my sponsor. She's too emotionally attached to me. She would not be objective. She's saying, when you going to get a sponsor? So we pull up to the meeting the other night. And I say, I was thinking about asking that guy to be my sponsor. She said, well, there he is. He's standing right there. He's standing right there in the parking lot. that defensiveness and that resistance was there? No, I don't want to take that leap. Because it means I will have to change. I will have to change and adapt. That's why it's important to do this work. It's imperative, now that I know there's a solution, I really need to get into and understand the ramifications of this illness. I got the doctor's opinion. I know there's a solution. Now I need some additional information because I have to clear the groundwork for me to take this enormous leap. It's an enormous leap of faith. See, you ask the average newcomer, and even me, when I first came to AA, before working with Jack, doing the big book and doing all that stuff, you ask me, what's the first step, Jerome, in recovery? And I'll pop up. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. That's not the first step in recovery. Because before you get to that point, you have to do some ego deflation. Without any ego deflation, there can't be any recovery. Just going and admitting that I have a problem with alcohol and telling you and telling anybody else significant in my life is not taking the first step. That's an intellectual exercise. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a genius to know that alcohol is causing you a problem, to admit it. All you have to do is think about them. Well, why did I do that? All you have to do is think, all Jerome has to do is think about all those hundreds and thousands of times when I've come to and ask myself that question. I didn't ask anybody else. I'm asking that to me. Why do you do that? Why? Why do you act like that? Why do you do that after you know what it does to you? just admitting ain't going to get you nowhere. What they saying is, in More About Alcoholism on page 30, it talks about it real clearly. It says, none of us like to admit that we're bodily and mentally different. Nobody likes that. But in order to do the first step in recovery, we have to learn to concede to our innermost selves, not self, selves, that we are bodily and mentally different. Any idea like we are like those other people has to be smashed. Any idea that some reservation or some new miracle or control is going to pop up has to be smashed. Anything that interferes with my sobriety and my recovery has to be smashed. Because I have to admit total, absolute, complete defeat. Not just intellectually. I have to admit in my heart. My heart has to be involved in this. And I have to give my heart to this power that's going to save me. And I have to back it up with my resolve. You remember it says sometime in the book, it says, remember we said we would go to any length? Go to any length for what? For a spiritual experience. But see, I have reservations. I have a script. Yes, I have a script. I didn't write a script out for my recovery. It's my unreasonable demand to God that it fit, his script fit mine. But he might not want me to do that. He might have something in store for me. So once I've learned through this process, because see, it's a learning experience. As you stand sober and working the rest of the program, learning to concede, learning to surrender to God's will. Because why? It's the proper use of the will. I've tried willpower. Willpower don't work. It just won't work. Marshaled by my will, it won't work. Because I will always be in collision with somebody or something. So now that I've gotten that part, now I need to find me my own personal relationship with a loving and living God. I can't use Jack's God. But in the beginning, Jack's God was real good. I literally did what he told me to do. He said, Jerome, when you get out of that bed, I want you to throw that pillow on the floor. And while you're down there picking it up, I want you to ask my God to keep you sober today. I want you to ask my God not to get you into any trouble that my God can't get you out of. And as you go through the day, if you have any issues or any confrontations, I want you to call me first. He said, I don't want to go on no plane rides. How do you put it? He said, I want to go on all the plane rides. I want to be on the takeoff and the landing. I just don't want to be on no landing. You calling me up trying to help me land this plane, and I'm on the ground and you up in the air. And he says, when you go to bed at night and you ain't got drunk that day and you ain't got in any trouble my God couldn't get you out of, I want you to thank my God. Then I start allowing other people to tell me their message. I'm going to go on a sidetrack. Have you ever wondered why and how Christianity has spread and is still a fervent message today? They didn't have no internet. They didn't have no telegraph, no television. You know what it was? It was the power of a story. And this is the whole essence of this. The power of a story that God will touch your heart and transform your life if you allow him. Because like I said, I told you I was an agnostic and a belligerent unbeliever. And Jack showed me how to get in touch with this God, because he told me, I want you to read the lost chapter in the big book. He called it chapter 4, We Agnostics. And just recently, I guess first part of last year, I was reading my book, as I usually do, and it just jumped out at me like I had never seen it before. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that neither God is everything or neither God is not. And I always like to ask, neither God can or he can't. What was my choice to be? See, that's the whole part of this spiritual development and recovery. I have to treat my spiritual malady every day. If I leave it to fend for itself, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. Then I'm looking for some artificial spirit to transform me. Because of my propensity to go insane. Because I'll go 23 hours, 59 minutes, and 55 seconds. In that last 5 seconds, I'll say, 2 tears in a bucket and... And that's that 5 seconds when I need to be on my knees, on the phone, and I need to find me another person. See, because I'm more reconciled to going to another human being with God in the presence than just going to God alone. I've tried that method and it's not effective enough. But when I go to my brother and I confess my faults and I expose myself, and it's, as they call it in the therapeutic community, self-disclose, that's how I get healed. That's how I stay connected to this power. And like I told you, when I came here, I didn't have no Bible skills. I was totally lost. I'm getting a message. I'm almost through. I promise I wouldn't go over. And I'm looking at my speaker chairman. She think I can't see her, but I can see her. You know, it was this guy in my home group. His name is Emmett. And I wanted a job bad. And I got turned down for a job, 2 jobs. First, my dad told the people that I didn't live here and I don't know where he is. He's probably drunk. So I didn't get the job. I wasn't drunk. He was just angry. And then I went to this here interview four times for an interview for a custodian's job at the studios. It was going to pay really, really good. And I thought I got it at the fourth interview, because I went all there, wino sharp, tied, looking, didn't look like no wino. And they had asked me about my background. I told them, I said, so I have a problem with alcohol. I've been sober a little over a year. And that's why I don't have a work record. And the people really believed me. But that last guy, he said, I don't care if you are sober. You won't never work on my lot. And you getting off this lot if I have to call security right now. I felt devastated. And I was at the meeting telling Emmett that I couldn't get that job because this man didn't want me to have this job because he was prejudiced against alcoholics and black people. And Emmett told me, he says, no, that's not the case, Jerome. He said, if that job was for you, that man could not stand in the way of you getting that job because God wanted you to have that job. Amen. And he said, we're going to treat this spiritually. See, that's where I found, beginning to find out early in my recovery, the power of prayer. More prayer, more power. No prayer, no power. And he pulled over to the curb and he says, give me your hands. We're going to treat this spiritually. you know, I was willing, so I gave my hand, but I wasn't all that comfortable with it because I didn't know what he wanted to do with my hands. In a car parked by the street at night, 11 o'clock at night. And he, Emmett began to pray that I get a job. While he's praying, I'm looking around to see who's looking in the car. And the next day, I'm sitting at the AA clubhouse with another loser, and this guy walks in. Never been there before. Does anybody in here need a job? I said, damn, God, not so quick. You know, I took that job. I took that job. That God sent me that job, and God has been taking care of me ever since. He's done more for me than I ever imagined that he could do for me. As hateful as I had been, as lost as I had been. See, I always like to think I'm like the prodigal son. I came back home to my dad's house after beating him down. He says, come on in, son, let's. And I tell you, my life has been truly blessed. What happened was, when that lady left the mental institution, I was sitting there really lost, feeling restless, irritable, and discontent. And I left out of a meeting at the mental institution, and it was this Jesuit priest. He was in there praying. And I stormed in there demanding why I don't have a personal God, why God doesn't love me, why God doesn't do this for me. And he sat and listened to me rant and rave. And he just administered to me. And he gave me a little tract. And it says, oh, how constant is your precious love, O Lord. I seek protection under the comforts of your wings. And he said, God is whatever you want him to be for you. And over the years, that thing has just grown and grown and grown. Because, see, I thought I could just do this recovery thing with just me and God and leave you out. And I was so deprived. So that night in that mental institution, I sit down and wrote this out. I always like to end with this. I really do. Because it really takes me back to when I was lost. And I know now that I've been found. I've been put in a position where life means something. See, the promises of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous have come true in my life. Because I did met the requirement. Because they told me, burn into the consciousness of every new man that he could get well despite anything or anybody. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. My whole house is clean today, not just the living room. And it's, oh, how constant is your precious love, O Lord. I seek protection under the comforts of your wings. For you have made this day. Let me rejoice and be glad in it. For today is the first day of my life. For the rest of my life, one day at a time. And thank you, dear God, just for this day. And may you lead and may you guide me in this prosperous new life. And may I never forget, during the sunshine of my life, during the storms of my life, and after the rains of my life, there's peace with you, dear God, always and forever. And all praise to the loving, living God, to whom all praise is due. I want to thank you, I want to thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for my sanity. I want to thank you for another day of sanity. And I want to thank you for allowing me to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you.